stray cat sitting on a fence. Ain't got enough dough to pay the rent. I'm flat broke, but I don't care. I strut right by with my tail in the air.
Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host for this Health Matters, during which we will talk about pet health. It is no coincidence that they selected me, Dr. Sanford Katz, to talk about pet health, and specifically, we'll talk a lot about dogs and cats. According to the ASPCA, 44% of households in the U.S. own dogs, and 35% of households are cat owners. 78 million dogs and 85 million cats live in U.S. households. Pets hold an important role in the quality of life for a lot of people in the United States, and proper health maintenance is key to ensuring those beloved pets to lead a fulfilling life and are around for many years of enjoyment. Joining me in the studio tonight will be Dr. Patrick Lavo, my co-host for the evening, and Dr. Lavo will be joining the Health Matters hosting team, and our guest tonight is Dr. April Mackey, a veterinarian with Town South Animal Hospital in Shreveport. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. This is, I think, a first.
I know. I hear it's a first. So maybe we'll have some more, though.
We've always done, human health. And this is the first time that we've dedicated a show specifically to our four-legged. Well, it's not even just four-legged.
I know,
there's all sorts. There's some of them are non-legged.
I just left the clinic to a three-legged kitten that I amputated a leg on earlier this week that is actually going to be up for adoption. So
left
a three-legged furry kid just a minute ago.
And I guess snakes don't have, right?
Yeah. You know, we don't see a ton of snakes. Dr. Pritchett, who is one of my associates, she loves the exotics. She saw a ferret today, and she's done some snake work and lots of birds and things like that. So we'll see the occasional weird thing.
Neat. Well, this evening, we, as always, invite our listening audience to call in with any pet health questions you might have to 1-800-552-8502. And if there are any pets out there who also would like to call in with a question, you're welcome as well. So this is a very appropriate time to be hosting a show on pet health because, for those in the listening area, it has been raining cats and dogs. And so I was wondering, where did that expression come from?
You know what? I don't have a clue. I think it is a little bit before my veterinary time, for sure. I don't know if I know the answer to that.
Well, I looked it up.
Good job.
So,
glad you did your research
now,
today.
Now, when we have the Health Matters quiz show, that is during the fun drive when we have people call in their pledges in lieu of an actual show, we often will have a quiz where, you know, we'll have questions out there, medical questions, and people are encouraged to call in, and then they'll upgrade their premium gift. There's no premiums being offered tonight, but I do want you to call in with an answer if you can think of one. It doesn't even have to be correct, as long as it's interesting, humorous, or believable. And then a little later, I'll tell the
reveal at the end.
I'll reveal it, unless someone actually gets it right. So anyway, to get started, Dr. Mackey, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what it takes to be a veterinarian?
Sure. Man, it takes a lot of work, fortunately or unfortunately. I remember being 7 years old and I knew that I wanted to be a vet, but it took me a long road. I spent a lot of time in undergrad and then 4 years at LSU for vet school. I'm a 2008 grad, and I worked in Las Vegas for 4 years right after vet school, and then moved back. Shreveport's home for me, so I've been back here a little bit over 5.5 years now, practicing at Town South. But it's not easy. You know, they say it's as hard or harder than medical school because it is so specialized and there aren't a ton of vet schools out there. But I'm so lucky, being a Louisiana native, that LSU is an amazing program there, and I had great training there.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I've also heard the same thing, that it's harder to get into veterinary school than
it's
it is to get into medical
school.
It's
pretty tough. It's straight A's, and yeah. It's a pretty small pool. I didn't get into vet school the first time I applied, and my mentor at Louisiana Tech said, "Just try one more time, kid," and I did, and I got in. So
yeah, I knew better than to apply.
It's a female-oriented world now, too, which is amazing. It's kind of made a churn. Over the last 15 to 20 years, it's become a much more female-oriented medical field than it used to be.
I see. And now, is there a residency associated with that?
So you definitely can become a veterinary specialist. There are veterinary radiologists, there are veterinary cardiologists, oncologists, the list goes on.
Veterinary radiation oncologists.
Yep. And so, but I chose to just be a general practitioner, which meant just 4 years of vet school, which was still plenty. Yeah. But there's, you know, surgical interns, and you do an internship and residency and become specialized. And that's a very specialized group of people.
Now, I understand there's large animal veterinarians and what do you call them? Small animal?
Yeah, medium size? I'm a small, I would consider myself a small animal vet.
Okay. And so in the schooling, you're qualified to do either one?
Yep.
And
well, they make you learn it all, unfortunately, in school. So I had a 6-week econ rotation. I took a large animal rotation in the barn, and, you know, we have to learn all about the chickens and the horses and everybody. But then at the end of the day, you get to choose what you want to go to work and see, thankfully.
Okay. So what would be a typical thing that you would see coming into your clinic?
So with us, it varies. A lot of wellness exams. Like today, I was slammed busy, but thankfully with a lot of wellness exams, which are kind of my favorite thing, because then I have the time to sit and talk to the owners and talk about wellness and prevention and those kinds of things. Then flip that to Monday, we had emergency after emergency, you know, and you never know what's gonna walk in the door. And right now, the emergency clinic is currently closed because they're out of power, and so we're the ER right now until 8 o'clock when we close.
Wow. Speaking of walking in the door, Dr. Patrick Lavo just arrived, and wanted to welcome him.
I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. Yeah. Nice to meet you, sir.
Oh, nice to meet you, too.
We were just talking about, what typically comes into the office, and so I guess that's a good place to start. Like, so what would be the, other than wellness, which we'll get into later, but what sort of problems people bring their pets in?
So I think one of the most common things I see, especially in Shreveport, Bossier, Louisiana, is allergies. We see allergies year-round, be it allergies to the pollen, allergies to fleas.
The animals have the allergies?
The animals absolutely have allergies, and it's interesting because they can present very differently than people present, I feel like. People, you know, nasal discharge and sinusitis and pain in their sinuses, whereas dogs can get itchy, runny noses, infected ears, infected skin, coughing, you know, red, itchy eyes. It can run the gamut. And it is something I probably see every single day.
Now, that's interesting because you always think about people having allergies to animals. And I know we all know the people who are like, oh, I can't come to your house. I'm sorry, you have a cat. I'll explode. But that's interesting that dogs and cats, and I guess you don't think about that because theoretically they lived
common
in nature when they started. So this
is a great way to keep some of those relatives that you don't want come visiting
that
you.
Is true.
Say, you know what? My dog's allergic to you.
Well, oh, and they can be allergic to their human's dander. We have a test that we can run to do true allergy testing, and it's interesting the things they'll come back allergic to, and human dander is on that list.
Yeah. Humans have dander.
Yeah, that
I've learned so much. I've been here for 3 minutes, and I know way more than I did.
And you know a lot about allergies. And sinus.
We'll see. That's yes, but the people side of things. Sometimes I wonder actually where the sinuses on my dog are located.
I can show you an x-ray.
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about that.
That's, you know, I've wondered a lot. I have a dog as well, and there's anatomy in the dog that I was totally unaware of, particularly the anal glands.
Yeah, those are fun.
Oh, my goodness. So apparently you can't just give your dog a bath at home. That's not a full service bath. So you send him to the groomer,
right,
and they take care of these anal glands.
You get a mani-pedi and an anal gland expression.
Yeah, so while we're on the topic of animal anatomy, could you explain what these anal glands are?
So it's interesting, and it's very, very old anatomy, because it was before these guys were couch potatoes and domesticated animals. They were, you know, dogs and cats on the plains of Africa, and these anal glands were used to express after they went potty to mark their territory, basically. Mm. But they, unfortunately, now as domesticated animals, don't do a great job sometimes of marking their territory, so I have to help them out occasionally.
So that's part of the more glamorous aspect.
Yes, 20 years of school and a whole lot of student loans.
So what are the consequences of not having these expressed? I mean, because this
Great
is
question.
Clearly a service that you, this is optional when you take your dog to the groomer. Now, would you like the deluxe
package?
It's
not optional. If you're going to send your dog to the groomer, you want these.
If you're going to do it right,
well,
you have to get them
Well, I can tell
expressed.
You guys, really, on a serious note, I actually recommend a veterinarian express anal glands and not groomers express anal glands, because just a great question that they can absolutely get infected or inflamed. We get anal gland abscesses that are completely ruptured through the skin. And so, and there's also a tumor of the anal gland that a more trained finger should be feeling than the groomers. Now, the groomers can do them, but a licensed vet can actually go in a little bit deeper than the groomers
should. It's a good thing they don't let just anybody get into vet school.
See why it's so hard?
So this is a good time to remind our listeners that if you have a question about anal glands or anything else regarding pets, please give us a call at 1-800-552-8502. Okay, so you mentioned allergies as a very common thing this time of year that you might see. What else?
So, man, dogs especially, probably not a day that goes by that I don't see them for some sort of GI upset, diarrhea, vomiting, because they're, unfortunately, they're dogs and they put things in their mouths that they shouldn't, be it toys or just licking the ground. Or just today, I think I saw four dogs for vomiting and diarrhea. And the good news is most of the time it's nothing. The bad news is, you know, it can be as terrible as a foreign body obstruction. And I've seen some pretty cool yet crazy foreign body obstructions with these guys. They'll eat rings and pacifiers and towels and
homework.
Yeah, homework. Lots
they
of homework.
Homework
digests, unless it's, you know, a three-ring binder. But definitely GI upset is something that we commonly see with dogs.
Now, what kind of diagnostic equipment do you have?
At Town South, we're pretty lucky. I'm really spoiled. Dr. McFadden, the owner of the clinic, does spoil us a bit. We've got digital x-ray. I've got a great ultrasound that I can do, ultrasound of the GI tract if necessary. We have full in-house blood work. We can do a lot.
Wow.
That's really high tech. You don't see that all behind the scenes when you walk
and,
your pet
you know,
into
I'm
the vet.
I'm a one-stop shop. I'm your radiologist as well.
Can I ask a question about some of this tech? Lasers. I've seen this written out like laser animal therapy, but they don't say what is. Is this like doggy LASIK? Like, what are we doing here? Am I preventing my dog's need for reading glasses later in life?
No. So we actually have a therapeutic laser as well, and the uses for a therapeutic laser are
like when you have the cat chase it around the floor.
Well, that is one use, but this is a little bit different.
Oh, all right, that's the only therapeutic use I've gotten so far.
And so we've got two types of lasers. I have a cutting surgical laser that I love and use in surgery, and it really decreases inflammation when you use that in surgery, and it increases your healing time. And then the therapeutic K laser, we use it for dogs that have arthritis, that have back disease, that have wounds. I use it during dental procedures. What it does is increases the blood flow to whatever you're treating, and it decreases the inflammation by using laser therapy. Ours has four different frequencies that it uses to treat the animal, and it's really cool because it's not a medicine, and people really like that actually because you know, I've got a whole pharmacy of things I could send you home with, but if you come in and actually get a laser treatment. And we've had back dogs that are near paralyzed, and through some rest and some laser treatments, they've had some significant improvement. So the laser is actually a really cool piece of equipment.
Holy cow. we do have our first caller. This is Karen from Dangerfield, Texas. Karen, welcome to Health Matters.
We're having some storms in the area.
We're having some storms in the area. Let me try that again. Okay, let's try that again. Karen from Dangerfield, Texas.
I'm here.
Oh, good. Welcome to Health Matters. What's your question?
Thank you. I have a 12-year-old Shih Tzu who's fairly small. She's only about 5.5 pounds. And has always had some health issues, mainly due to being so small when she was born. But here lately, her sleep patterns have changed drastically, not just a little. She used to sleep in between myself and my husband, and now she wants out at like 2 o'clock to urinate, which we consider that old age. But sometimes she'll just stand like she's staring up into space, and she can't get comfortable. And she'll stand there instead of curling up like she used to. And we just don't know why she's so disoriented. What should we do?
So, great question.
Other than take her to the vet.
Is she said she's 12 years old?
Yes.
Okay. you know, a couple of things. It's hard. Now, I'm going to be honest with you guys that over the radio, talking about, you know, diagnosing things is a little bit more difficult than hands-on. But I can tell you that at 12 years old, she's considered a geriatric, right? And so when we think geriatric, we think little old lady in the nursing home age, okay? And so if we're comparing it to people, and you worry, and we do see true cognitive dysfunction in dogs, especially at a geriatric age. And so what you describe potentially is the beginnings of some cognitive dysfunction, but, you know, not true Alzheimer's. We don't have that true diagnosis in dogs, but cognitive dysfunction is absolutely something we see in geriatric dogs. And so potentially her kind of change in sleep pattern and her staring off into space is the beginnings of cognitive dysfunction. There are supplements out there that you can use, omega fatty acids, and there's actually some diets that work really well for cognitive dysfunction.
Well, we were going to take her to the vet.
Yeah, I think that, you know,
vet said that, I mean, now all of a sudden she's developed cataract.
Okay.
And, yeah, and but we're worried she's having strokes.
Well, and that's definitely something, you know, at that age you're concerned about true seizures or strokes. And I think that some routine blood work would be a really good idea. Dogs that develop cataracts are highly prone to diabetes. And so if she's developed some cataracts and hasn't had blood work recently, even within the last couple of months, that can change really quickly in these older dogs. And so I think a nice vet check with maybe some nice routine senior blood work would be a really good idea for you guys.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
Karen,
so welcome.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
So, you know, that is not an uncommon thing. I understand people's pets get older. They start to lose function. I know sometimes they lose continence. They get disoriented and things of that sort. And it can be very difficult, just like watching a loved one, you know, a human loved one experiencing this. And it's very difficult, I know, for pet owners. So how do you deal with end-of-life issues?
You know, it's actually sometimes an unfortunate thing that we've gotten so good at our jobs with all of our cool, fancy toys that we see dogs living to routinely past 15 years of age. And because of that, though, you truly see, you know, their body is just given out on them, and even though everything that you can do. And, you know, it sucks, to be honest, that as a veterinarian, I'm the only human being on the planet that's licensed to kill things, as terrible as that sounds to say, but it's the reality. I had a euthanasia today. And it's tough. I cry pretty much at every euthanasia. I still do, because it's an emotional roller coaster. But my job as a veterinarian, I signed an oath to prevent suffering. I'm not going to let it happen. And so if your animal is suffering and there's nothing else that we can do, you know, humane euthanasia is an option that we have that's very specific to veterinary medicine. And like I said, it's tough. Today the lady still looked me dead in my face and she said, I thought my job sucked.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, ma'am, it's sometimes it's tough.
Yeah, it's humane for animals, but it's obviously controversial for people.
Yep.
But I mean, many places in the world, the same humane, you know, practice is not uncommon.
It is something that, you know, stops suffering. And dogs specifically are so stoic. It's amazing. Yeah. You'll see these guys come in and you know they have to be in extreme pain and they're wagging their tails and panting and wanting to eat a bowl full of food. And so that's the other thing that makes it so tough. A, they don't talk to me, but they're just so stoic. They're so tough.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned that age range, 12 to 15, because I think that's the same age I was when my parents considered euthanasia for me.
Me too, man.
I know that's just a very common age for that consideration to come up.
Yeah.
So I do have a question for you. So I've heard, you know, you see sometimes pictures of people with unusual pets. What is the weirdest pet someone has brought into your office and has said, Doc, I think my koala is sick, you know?
We saw let me think about this. You know, we've seen pet snakes. We've seen pet rabbits. We had a rabbit spay today. We saw a lemur. That's probably the most unusual one that we saw. And lemurs are actually illegal to own in the state of Louisiana. But
do you have like a duty to report that?
This lemur lived in Texas.
Oh,
so
okay.
We were okay.
It was a Texas lemur.
The lemur ate lollipops the whole time it was there. It came for some vaccines. Then it proceeded to bite one of my nurses, but very gingerly. So it wasn't too big of a deal. But I think the lemur was probably the most unique thing that we've seen. But like I said, we see a decent amount of exotics. We're lucky in that aspect.
We've got phone calls just ringing off the hook here.
I hope it's not my family.
No, it's great. So let's go to KT from Northern Arkansas.
All right, y'all. That's my mom. That's my mom.
Is that really your mom?
Mom.
I will try not to drop her call. Okay.
KT, welcome to the show.
Mom, is this you? Oh, no.
Oh, man.
Oh, she was good. Mom, call back.
Okay. I knew she was going to
do
that.
So let's try Christina from...
Because you called her out.
That's it.
I know.
Christina from Timpson, Texas. Christina?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you taking my call.
Oh, thanks for calling. But before we get started, do you know the answer to why it's called Raining Cats and Dogs?
Oh, I do not.
Okay. All right. What's your question?
Okay. My question is, there where you're from, have you seen any cases of distemper lately?
Good question. You know, we see suspect cases, I think, occasionally. Distemper is not a common disease, thankfully, due to a really great vaccine. But it's very difficult to actually diagnose distemper. And so I can tell you that within the last couple of months, we've had a suspect distemper dog. But the true diagnosis of distemper is really difficult. It's very different from some of our other contagious diseases that we vaccinate against, like parvo. Parvo has a great test. It's easy to test. It's easy to diagnose. But distemper is actually relatively difficult. And the outcome for distemper is never really good, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had a rescue puppy that ended up, didn't get diagnosed, but ended up dying from it. And now we're scared that, we're just wondering how many cases are kind of going around. And
yeah, I haven't, and things like that definitely tend to come in waves. And so when we see one distemper, one suspect distemper, especially coming from a humane society or a shelter, you're going to tend to see more. But upper respiratory disease, which is how distemper usually initially presents, there's a million other things that present the exact same way. So that's why it's hard to diagnose.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Good luck. Clean a lot, and I think you'll be okay.
Okay, thank you so much.
No
I really
problem.
Appreciate you.
Thank you so much for your call, Christina.
Thank you for taking it. I appreciate y'all. Have a good day.
You too.
Okay.
Right, bye-bye.
We have Mary from Nacogdoches. Mary, welcome to Health Matters. Mary? Okay, we'll try. Okay, Mary, well, call back if you can. So is this, unless it's Melanie, could it be Melanie on? No. Okay. Well, moving on. One of the difficult things I imagine in veterinary health is that you don't have the benefit of your patient being able to give you a history. They always teach us in medical school that history is taking the history, the story from the patient will give you the answer most of the time. How do you deal with this when an animal comes in?
I think it's all in a good physical exam. We're the pediatrics of the human world. I think they compare us a little bit to the pediatrics because the pediatric human world doesn't talk to you much. I think it's in a good history from the owner. I think it's in just experience of seeing. I remember in vet school, one of my mentors said, common things occur commonly, and zebras are zebras. And it's so true because I can walk in a room and a lot of times know what's going on just from the history of an owner. But that being said, sometimes, a good physical exam, a dog will come in for scratching and it has on physical exam something completely different. And so a good, thorough physical exam in veterinary medicine is worth a million bucks. And, my nurses are great because they get great histories for me. And again, that's so important to know what's been going on, how long has it been going on, what do they change? Do they have people visiting at home and that's why the dog has diarrhea? Do they feed it a hamburger and now it's vomiting? Because those are things that really help me figure out the mystery that is their animal.
Okay, we have more callers. We've got callers calling. We can't even keep track of who's calling on what line. To be honest,
two-thirds of them are probably related.
So
to me,
I'm just gonna answer the call and see who it is. It'll be a surprise. Okay, welcome to Health Matters. Who do we have on the line?
My name's Chris Jonesy. What's up?
Hi, Chris. You're calling from Longview, huh?
That is correct.
Okay, so before we get started with your question, do you know why the expression, it's raining cats and dogs? Do you know where that comes from?
Yes, that's back when they had thatch roosts in the day, and cats and dogs used to sleep up in the rafters, and any time it rained, you see them just jumping down.
Well, now I know.
Now, did you look this up, or did you just know this from your own experience with thatch roofs?
I've got kids in high school, and they come up with weird things to come tell me, so...
Well, fun fact. Now I know.
All right. Excellent. You win our admiration.
Congrats.
And respect. So what is
Believe
your...
Nah, it's my kids.
Yeah. Well, they do too. So what's your question?
Hey, here recently, I've got two dogs and two Shih Tzus, and they are like really scared of any loud noise, especially this past 4th of July. I was wondering, what can I do to either ease their discomfort, or what do I mean?
Man, great question. And it's actually a really hot button for me. It drives me crazy how many fireworks are in town, fancy neighborhood, and they're popping off things that should be for the country. And it really is an issue for dogs specifically. I have a dog that has thunderstorm anxiety as well as firework anxiety. And so it is a true anxiety that we see in dogs. And there are a couple of things that you can do. Just reducing that anxiety by, you know, trying to comfort them is obviously the first thing. But there is something called a thunder shirt that you can use. It's something you can just get at PetSmart that put on these guys. It's a very tight vest, basically. And I'd say that does work in some dogs. It definitely doesn't work in all dogs. The other thing that I use a lot of is true anti-anxiety medications. I'm not opposed to giving a dog a Xanax on a 4th of July night. It's definitely something that we do and prescribe. The other thing is just common sedatives. That's something like at my house, there's a medication called Aceclofenac, which is a true sedative. I hand those out like Tic Tacs when it's like a night like tonight. My guys are going to get a little sedative at the end of the night just to kind of take the edge off. But it is a real issue and a real phobia. And so I would say if you have a regular veterinarian and is something that is a real phobia for your guy, I would recommend potentially starting them on a medication or trying the thunder shirt. That's something that's really safe and easy to try. I don't see that it works in everybody, but it's something that is really easy and safe to try.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem, guys. Good luck. Hey, we made it through the 4th, so yeah. Now we just got to get to January 1st and get through that.
Thanks for your call, Chris. Yeah. Okay. Oops, sorry to cut you off. So this was now Mary, I believe, we have back from Nacogdoches?
Correct.
Oh, fantastic. Glad you called back. What's your question for Dr. Mackey?
I wanted to know if cow's milk is okay for kittens.
Good question. I would say if it's better than no milk at all, but there is something that, you know, if you have a litter of kittens that mom's not around, there's a great kitten milk replacer that's out there. It's readily available. It's actually more easy to digest than cow's milk. There's some different enzymes and things like that in the breed specific milks. And the other thing is if you've got a mama cat around, that's obviously the best because they get immunity and antibodies and things like that from the cat's milk that really help these kittens and help their immunity while they're so young. So obviously preferable is kitty cat milk. Like I said, if you've got nothing else, then I would say that's better than just plain water. But I would try and stick with either cat's milk or kitten milk replacer.
This is an older kitten that we caught, and she will need an amputation. She has a dislocated left front arm, but she's weaned. But when we come in from outside, she's hot. I had a little milk, and I just wanted if that's okay.
Yeah, you know, I think some cats can have a little lactose intolerance from milk, and my only complaint would be once she's an older cat, that might be a little too high in calories because the cats are so lazy, man. They don't require very many calories at all, and so I would just watch that weight and make sure that you're not getting overweight. And if the cat likes it and is handling it okay, I think it's not a problem.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem.
All right.
Thanks so much for your call,
bye-bye.
Mary. Okay, now we have Melanie calling from Shreveport. Melanie, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi. So my question is, we have a 4.5-year-old Doberman that we take for long runs for exercise. Is that okay for her joints to go on long runs? And if so, is there a distance that you would say that's enough, that's as far as she should go?
So I think right now, be careful in the heat on long runs. It's finally really gotten hot. The summer has been relatively mild, but once it hits in the 90s, I would say maybe cut your runs a little bit short when it's really hot. And, you know, dogs definitely can overheat, and so that is a problem, especially in Shreveport in the summertime. But I think if she enjoys it, I wouldn't overdo it. How what do you say when you say long run? How far are you going?
I mean, the most she ever does is like 6 or 7.
Six or seven, like Miles. Okay, man, that's kind of a lot. You know, and the thing about Dobies, I think they tend to be overweight, and so getting some exercise is a great idea. But I would keep it to maybe, you know, half that mileage wise, and then also add in a joint supplement. It's always great for large breed dogs, even if they're not exercising, to add in a joint supplement. Glucosamine chondroitin joint supplements, just like people take, they make that in a doggy version, and are really great for their joints, because these large breed dogs like Dobermans do tend to get arthritis with age. And so I just wouldn't overdo it. And maybe keep to, you know, 3 miles max. And again, in this heat, I wouldn't even go that far.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you, Melanie, for your call. We're going to move on to Rory from Natchitoches. Rory?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Welcome to Health Matters.
Yes, sir. I just a quick question about a cat. I have a cat. It's kind of old. It's about 11 or 12 years old, and it sometimes makes a noise like it's congested, you know, that kind of noise. I've taken it to the vet, and in most cases they say, no, she sounds nice and clear. We don't hear anything, you know. But the last time I did that, they whacked her with a couple of things and some kind of a worming medicine too, and she sort of at first had a bad reaction to it, foamed at the mouth, made all kinds of noises. I thought she was going to die, but she recovered and was okay, but a little out of her sorts for a day or so. And then I wasn't home, and I'm not sure it's her because I have more than one cat. I got two or three of them. And there's this one spot where she goes, and I found what looked like sort of a fur ball, and mixed in with the fur ball was something that looked like what I would call a tapeworm. It was brownish white and about 2 or 3 inches long. Is it possible for them to hark up a piece of tapeworm?
Yeah, it sounds more like a potentially a roundworm. Tapeworms are actually pretty small in size and in length, but cats and dogs definitely can get roundworms. And if this kitty cat is outside at all, then their potential exposure to things like roundworms and hookworms, which are common intestinal parasites in dogs and cats, they absolutely can vomit them up if they have a pretty good burden. And so with the breathing issue, cats can get asthma, and definitely it can progress with age. And so it stinks because I'm going to be recommending diagnostics because that's my job, and I think an x-ray on a kitty cat that age that's having some breathing problems would be a really good idea. Asthma is very easily seen on x-rays in kitty cats.
Okay, well we'll be going back then.
Great, that sounds great.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much for calling, Rory. Okay, we're going to move on, meow, to Walter from East Texas. Walter, welcome to Health
Hello.
Matters. Yeah. Is Walter?
Yes, sir. Are timber wolves susceptible to rabies? And does the human cure is the same for the wolves if they get the rabies?
So, good question. And so, if any animal it gets rabies, there's no cure, okay? And
they told me that your body develops the antibodies for it, but it's one day late. If you can induce a coma for those 2 days and let your body fight it, our bodies take care of the rabies. There was no trace of rabies in their system.
Oh, wow. That's new to me. So I've never quite heard of that.
It may save somebody's pet, you know. And I've got timber wolves, and I don't know how they correspond to what you've got.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't truly see a ton of timber wolves, but they definitely are susceptible to rabies. That's definitely my experience with it.
And they love skunks.
And they do love skunks. And definitely, you know, skunks are huge carriers of rabies, so I would be careful with that.
Well, they said that if a human gets rabies, if you can induce a coma for 2 days, your body takes your body's own antibodies it develops for it, kills the rabies.
Wow, that's
out.
That's cool.
I mean,
well,
it saves lives and things.
Yeah. Well, today,
especially people.
Yeah. Well, you know, tonight we're focusing on pets. But
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Timberwolves for pets.
And, yeah. But I think that's an interesting topic for perhaps another show. In fact, Dr. Lavo is going to be doing a show, and maybe that will be something
right.
we can cover.
We could talk about that.
But but Walter, we really appreciate your call.
I appreciate y'all. And tell Kermit, hey, good going.
Will do.
Now,
take care.
Before we move on, can someone explain to me, the Timberwolves are a basketball team from Minnesota, but outside of that, I don't actually know what a Timberwolf is. In my head, I'm envisioning Balto, but I don't think that's what this is.
Pretty close, actually. No offense to the previous caller, not pets, in my opinion. Sorry. They're not domesticated animals, but that's my humble veterinary opinion.
Oh, so are they true wolves? Like,
yeah.
Wild dog? Wow, cool.
How about that?
It's pretty awesome.
So you mentioned earlier, getting back to something I've always been curious about. You mentioned allergies in animals and dogs specifically. You know, you go to the pet store or the supermarket to buy pet food.
Ugh.
And it's incredible,
right?
It's overwhelming. They
for
seem
me
to,
as well.
Right. They seem to have, pet food specifically for specific breeds, for specific ages, for specific sizes, allergies, for all these different things. And it's very expensive. And how do you know what to buy?
You so much for asking.
Whatever happened to just feeding table scraps?
The easy days of when my grandmother had dogs, right?
Right. And in fact, it doesn't matter how much you spend on the dog food, the dog still begs at the table
exactly.
for whatever you're eating.
Well, don't
Their
feed
food
table
food.
No, I'm not necessarily encouraging that, but can you talk a little bit about that so we know, we should be buying?
Not too long ago, I was having a conversation with a veterinary nutritionist. And his latest numbers were somewhere around 3,000 to 3,500 new pet foods out every single year. And so when my clients walk in and say, hey, doc, I'm feeding Taste of the Whatever, and I've never heard of it, it's because it's a losing battle. I mean, the pet food industry is a $1 billion industry. And so it's something that is so difficult. It's a losing battle for me, and it's really it's something that is very, I think, on the front lines right now. People are crazy about what they feed and what they feed their dogs, and it's something that I think is so important to talk about. Is if you look on a bag of dog food, there's going to be a statement, and it's going to be in small letters. It's an AFCO statement, and AFCO is the kind of governing body over dog food and cat food and pet food in general. And the AFCO statement will tell you certain things about that food, and something that's really important to look for. If it says that the dog food is formulated sounds like a really cool fancy word, like this is formulated for my whatever. Formulated is a fancy word for a recipe. It means they mix something up, they put it in a bag, and they put a fancy label on it. Versus if it says it's a true dog food trial, and that's very different. And so a lot of the foods that have been around for a long time, those dog foods have had a lot of research behind them and actually have had feeding trials, and I think that's so important. People are buying food that literally is a recipe with a bag and a label, and then they're charging you $50 for it. And for me, it's so important to read the labels. Dogs don't need grain free. Dogs don't need organic. And this is such a trend.
Gluten free.
Gluten free, not a thing really in dogs.
Thing.
Not a thing. Food allergies in general are really rare. As we talk about allergies, food allergies are probably less than 3% of the allergies that I see. And then of those food allergies, gluten or grain allergies are 0.5% of that 3%. So let's do the math. That's a very, very rare thing. And it just stinks because the pet food industry is really ran with all of this stuff, and they're not doing their research. And it's frustrating because I see so many obese dogs people that are feeding raw diets and things like that. Man, you're looking for trouble doing that kind of stuff. So stick with those foods that have been around for a long time. And I'm not going to mention labels because I don't want people to think I'm getting paid by somebody. It's not about that at all. It's about what's in there and what research has been done.
I have been to some malls where they have kind of boutique-y type dog foods. You go in there and it looks like you're in a bakery where the food is so appetizing and delicious. And it looks like you're at a wedding.
Right.
And I want to eat it.
I know. I've eaten some of it.
And
it's not too bad.
It's not too bad. And it's like, I can't even imagine.
Well, and I think some people have good intentions. When people start things like that, they have good intentions of it being organic and homemade and that kind of stuff. But it's a really difficult thing to keep up with and the regulations just aren't there, unfortunately. And that's something that is just, it needs to be worked on. And nobody can figure out whose job it is to do that.
People seem to have a lot of money to spend on their pets.
Yeah, they do.
And it's like my dog's favorite place to get food is, know, in the trash. I mean, you know, it's all that we could do to keep the dog out of the trash. And, you know, obviously that's not good for the dog. We try to keep the trash away, but, you know, I'm sure not going to go out and spend $10 on a cupcake for the dog.
Some people will.
Oh, my goodness. So, I'm sorry. Dr.
No, I was going to say that, you know, when you're walking through the pet food aisles, they're stratified by how much you love your dog. You can tell because the first aisle is like $10 a bag. The second aisle is $20 a bag. The third aisle, there's a question mark by it, and you have to be very bold and bring it up to the register, and then they'll tell you how much you owe. is there a realistic price range that you can say, you know, if you stick in this range, you're probably going to find a healthy food. It's going to be, because, you know, some you can buy 50 pounds of food for $10, and you can buy 10 pounds of food for $75.
Yeah. I would say don't buy the low end. There's definitely stuff out there that's crap. And if you look online, there used to be a website, and I can't remember what it is anymore, but back 5 years ago, they graded pet food where you got an A+ to an F-. And there's so many of those really popular foods out there, Beneful being one of them, F- on the grade. And, you know, people love those diets. And I would say, again, don't buy the $10 bag, but it may not be necessary to buy the $100 bag. But it's hard to answer because every dog's different. If you've got a geriatric dog with kidney disease, they're going to need a very specific diet, and it's more likely going to be an expensive diet. But it's just, it makes me kind of sad because people are willing to spend $80 on a bag of grain-free organic, something I've never heard of, but they won't let, it's hard for me to talk them into heartworm testing and things like that. And so, like I said, it's a hot topic right now.
You know, We had a little lull in the calls, so I'm going to give the number again. It's 1-800-552-8502. But in the time that we have before someone calls in, I do want to talk a little bit about wellness. You mentioned that before. You see a number of people for wellness. I understand that there's keeping your animal healthy is very important. There's vaccinations and other things that you do to keep dogs healthy and cats healthy and other animals healthy. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that's so important because these guys don't talk to us. Yearly wellness or even semi-annual wellness is something that's so important. Get those guys in. It's not even necessarily about the vaccines, which are important, but it's more about, like I said, the physical exam, noticing that the dog's gained 10 pounds or noticing that the dog's chewing at its tail, noticing it has fleas. Heartworm prevention is hugely important in Louisiana specifically. Mosquitoes are out of control, and heartworm disease is the vector. Mosquitoes are the vector for that. And so it's something that heartworm prevention needs to be given every single month for your pet. We recommend it also in cats. It is not a disease of cats, but it is something that is possible. And so we recommend heartworm prevention in dogs and cats, either in a monthly supplement or there is a six-month shot that's great for heartworms. That's easy for the people like me who can't remember to do something every single month. And, you know, again, also flea prevention. As we talk about allergies, dogs can be allergic to fleas. And so even one bite from a flea, the saliva from that bite can send them into just trigger a horrible allergy. And so flea prevention is so important as well. And we're so lucky. We have so many options, even combinations that are flea and heartworm prevention that you can give monthly that are so important.
Okay, well, we have another caller. We have Kevin from Alexandria. Kevin, welcome to Health Matters.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question, and I'll ask it, and then I'll let y'all answer off the air. I'm curious if there's any, you know, data or to support, or like in your experience, if you find that in general, like purebreds seem to have more health problems in general than, say, just like a regular old mutt. And I'll just throw it out there and let y'all answer. Thank you.
My vote is heck yeah, purebreds have more problems. It's unfortunate that in the breeding practices with, you know, backyard breeders, as we call them, and people that are in it for the money, there's a lot of inbreeding has occurred. And the other thing is some of these fancy breeds that we look at, we want them to look a certain way. In bulldogs, we want them to be really smushy and really round. And those things have been inbred into them, unfortunately. And, you know, a good mixed breed for me is something I think that is a whole lot less problem. And the other thing is I'm a huge supporter of adoption, and you don't necessarily, if you're looking for a specific breed, you can find that if you look hard enough, even through an adoption. You know, there's so many rescue facilities out there that have even purebreds, but absolutely I think purebreds have a history of more problems than a good old mutt, because if you're thinking of it just genetically, if my mom and dad are my brother and sister, that's not going to end well typically. But if you've got a mutt, you know they're not related. And so I think that's important.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. We have more. We have more callers. We have Alexis from East Texas. Alexis, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi. I have always had small dogs in the past, and last year I rescued a standard poodle. It's my first large dog. I've read a lot about bloat, which I had never heard of before, having small dogs. But can you talk a little bit about that, and what is it, and what are signs and symptoms to look for?
Sure. Great question. And I would say, luckily, standard poodles are not my number one breed for bloat. So two things. If anybody's ever seen the movie Marley and Me, this is what Marley died of. And it's not necessarily just bloat. It's what we call a GDV. So it's a gastric volvulus with dilation. And the dilation is the bloat part, but the volvulus is the bad part. And what that means is the stomach, it flips on itself, and it causes a immediate emergency in the dog. And these are some of the most critical animals you'll ever see. It cuts off blood supply to the aorta when the stomach flips like that, which is, the aorta is your main vessel that feeds your heart. And so it definitely is a true veterinary emergency. We do see it way more commonly in our large breed, deep chested dogs. And so standard poodle definitely does fit that. It is more common in our really giant breeds. So our Great Danes and things like that. I think Great Danes are definitely overrepresented. Couple of things to really do that can help. Make sure you're feeding your dog more than just once a day. So the reason a lot of times these guys bloat, it happens more often in the summer. They eat a big meal, they drink a bunch of water, they go outside, and everything swells up. And so that's where the bloat happens. And then it flips on itself because it's so bloated and filled with food and water and air at this point. And so if you will do smaller, more frequent feedings, that's really helpful. Don't let them drink a ton of water after they eat. And also minimize exercise after these giant breeds eat can really, really help decrease the potential of bloat. The other thing that you can do as a preventative, you can actually do what we call a gastropexy. And we recommend this in any of our giant breeds. Dr. Leah Hunter, who's my associate at Town South, that's one of her favorite surgeries, and I'm glad because I hate it. But what you do is actually you pexy the stomach, or you actually suture the stomach to the body wall. And by doing that, it prevents the stomach's ability to flip over. And so that's something that's definitely recommended in these big dogs to prevent the possibility of bloat.
Alexis, thank you so much for your call this evening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next up, we have Barbara from Alexandria. Barbara, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi. Listen, I have three Portuguese water dogs, and I'm looking at 12 little Portuguese water dog puppies that are 4.5 weeks old. Yes, it's been a long
time. I bet you need some sleep.
I need a lot of sleep, and there's at least another 5 weeks to go because they don't leave for a while. But the question I have is H3N2 canine influenza. It's kind of the hot topic in the dog circle.
Yep, it is.
And we know that it is in Louisiana. What I'm asking is, the recommendations for vaccination on this is not something that we've normally vaccinated for, and I do know it's a bivalent vaccine, meaning we have to give two vaccines to cover. What would you recommend that we do? I mean, I'm not going to vaccinate little teeny tiny puppies, but I do have adults in the house, and I question whether I should go ahead and vaccinate. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, I think, again, you guys are calling with awesome questions. These are literally things that are on my list of things I wanted to talk about tonight. So great job. All right, let's talk about this. So H3N2 is new. That's how my dumb self has to remember it. Two is new. And so we used to have H3N8. It was a canine influenza. Very, very rare, but very deadly. The new strain is the H3N2, and it is not as deadly, but way more contagious. And we absolutely have seen cases in Monroe. We've seen some cases in Houston. It's scary enough that I can tell you we got together at Town South, got me and the medical director and the office manager sat down and said, okay, let's start carrying this vaccine. We have always carried the H3N8. We are a progressive practice that believes in being progressive about your vaccines. And so canine flu, even the old flu strain, was something we always recommended and had all of our boarders do. But a couple of weeks ago, we went and got the bivalent combo vaccine. So it's got the N2 and the N8 in it. And so that's what we're recommending now. And look, dogs that don't leave the house, their exposure, I guess, is reduced. But it is scary enough that my dog dogs. I brought them up to the clinic, which I never do because there's four of them, and we started the series of vaccines. Something really important to remember, though, if you are starting it, because this is a brand new strain, the booster is critical, okay? If you're doing one vaccine and then not coming in for your booster in 2 to 4 weeks, you're doing a disservice. It's pointless. You've got to do the booster, and what we're doing is not charging for any exams. When these guys come in for the boosters, we're just charging for the vaccine to try and get people in the door, because it's a brand new strain, and the booster is so important because these guys have no immunity to this disease right now.
All right, so we have one final call from Terry, calling from Longview.
Wow, this has been fast. It's almost over.
I knew it would be a hot button topic. We talked about this. We knew people would have questions.
We lost Terry. So, Terry, you can try to call back. However, I have to say we've lost power at the station, so it's possible you might not get through.
Oh,
but
darn.
The show must go on.
I know. I was having fun.
And I have a follow-up question for you, I guess. So we talk about these vaccines. Are there any, you know, in the human world, we've got, you know, the vaxxers and the anti-vaxxers, yes. And there's this big, you know, the rise of vaccines correlates with the rise of autism, that sort of thing. Is there an anti-vaxxer population amongst pet owners? Are there any real risks associated with vaccinations that you're aware of?
Yeah,
I have to first say that the health community, the health professional community, does not support the argument that vaccines cause autism.
Oh,
I was actually about to ask you guys
debunked.
That.
There's not a whole lot of truth. So we first have to disqualify that as a reasonable theory. Okay.
A fair point.
So autism, dogs don't talk to us, and so we don't see a lot of autism in dogs, so there's not necessarily any complaints with that link. But there's definitely a subset of anti-vaxxers in the dog community and, like, the fancy cat community. And when it stinks, and no offense to you breeders out there, a lot of times I see it coming from a breeder community where these people pay $1,000 for some fancy dog, and the breeder has two pages of recommendations, and most of them are saying don't go to your vet, don't trust them, they're money grubbing jerks, you know, and you don't need vaccines, they're pointless, and or only give this vaccine and don't give this vaccine. And you know, my recommendation is listen to your vet and listen to their recommendations, just like with you guys. I mean, you know, vaccines are important, and you know, it sometimes I think it is kind of weird when I'm seeing a 15-year-old dog and he's getting his 15th rabies shot of his life. You know, his titers are probably great, let's be honest, but it's still that's required by law, but it's still important. And these are diseases that we see. I mean, we don't see rabies every day, but these are diseases that we see, and I want to keep them up to date and protected, just like we didn't used to see polio and now we had a great vaccine in humans, and now people are not wanting to do that, or whooping right. cough and things
there's,
like that.
I mean, there's obviously a huge advantage to the gene pool being grossly immune to certain diseases, and that has a lot to do with their eradication.
Yep.
But
speaking of the gene pool, you said something about reputable breeders. How does somebody know if they have a reputable breeder? How do they find one?
I think it's really hard. I think it's just best to do your research. There are definitely breeders out there that are great, and that, you know, want to do home visits before they allow, you know, these dogs to be bought. The other thing I'd say, one thing that's something that's easy to recommend, is if you're going to buy a dog from somebody, meet them at the house where this dog lives. There's so many people that are like, hey, I'll meet you at the Chevron down the road. That's sketchy. Like, and so you want to see mom and dad. You want to see where these dogs are being bred, because those people that don't want you in their home, it's probably not because they're skeeved out by you. It's because they're the skeevy one.
Yeah,
sure.
And how about spay and neutering?
So something that's so important, guys, I think... In
you
Shreveport,
know what Bob Barker says.
That's right, Bob Barker. He started it years ago. You know... For me, the talk that I have with owners, it's not about Fluffy going and getting pregnant or you know, your boy dog making babies. Most of these animals, at least that I see, I'm so lucky. I'm spoiled that my clients are great. But these dogs aren't out making babies. But what they are doing is getting disease with age. Boy dogs specifically, first things first, the behavioral issue of not neutering a dog. Boy dogs are going to be boy dogs, which means they're going to mark their territory. And their territory might be your nice purse on the floor. And and they're going to pee in your house. They're going to hike their legs. And if you neuter them at a relatively young age, you're going to stop that habit. And that's something that is nice for people. But there's a true medical aspects that are important of spays and neuters. Boy dogs can get prostate issues, just like little old men get prostate issues. And they can get prostatitis. They can get infections. They can get prostate cancers. And it stinks to have that conversation with an owner, their dog's got prostate cancer, when it's all preventable by a neuter. If you neuter a dog at a young age, the prostate goes away, it atrophies away to nothing, and it's so preventable, you know. And flip side with females, they can get pyometras, which is an infection of the uterus, and that is when we talk about bloat being a critical emergency, a female with a pyometra is a critical emergency. That's one of my top fives. That's an infection in the uterus, and it usually gets trapped in there, so you basically have a uterus full of pus that's ready to explode. Mm. And you spay that dog before that happens. Obviously it is way easier surgery, and you don't have a critically ill dog. Mammary cancer is way more common in intact females. Even one heat cycle can predispose these guys to mammary cancer down the road. There are some new studies coming out that are a little controversial about early spay and neuters. And for me right now, what I was taught was early, you know, 6 months to a year, we're going to spay and recommend spay and neuter. Like I said, there's some new kind of hot topic research about delaying spays and neuters, specifically in retriever type dogs because of some hip dysplasia issues. Like I said, it's up and coming, and that's my job to do my CE and keep up with what's, you know, changing about the recommendations. But right now, our blanket recommendations are early spay and neuter. It's so important.
You know, you mentioned cancer, and that's obviously an area of my interest. It's what I'm an oncologist, and it does always amaze me how much people spend treating their animals, their pets who have cancer. And there are, as you said, there are veterinarians who specialize in oncology. This all, I imagine, gets pretty expensive. You can't put a value on a life or what your pet means to you. However, are there health insurance or pet insurance policies people can purchase?
Absolutely. And the one thing that I totally support pet insurance just in general, but it's hard because a lot of people have gotten on that bandwagon as well. And so, you know, 10 years ago when I first started this, there were two pet insurances out there, and now there's hundreds. And so, again, it's kind of like the pet food problem. People come to me and say, hey, Dr. Mackey, have you heard of this pet insurance? And I haven't, and I don't have time to look into it, right? And you got to read the fine print. Some of those insurance policies are crap, but some of them are really great. Can I say crap?
I don't know. You said it twice.
You already did. And multiple times.
Yeah, but you're a veterinarian, so you deal with a lot
that's
of
right.
crap.
That's right. Sorry. Hey, you're lucky I didn't say anything worse.
So are you allowed to say I'm the only one here who's not in trouble now? I didn't say it yet.
I'm not going to get invited back. Darn it.
No, let me tell you something. There has been so many calls. I think you've set a record in terms of number of calls.
Cool.
You are definitely coming back. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they asked you to do your own show. We've run out of time.
Oh, man, this
been great. I can't thank you enough, Dr. Mackey, for coming
in. Thank
y'all
so much
and talking.
For putting up with me.
I know our listeners, they all appreciate it, obviously, and I appreciate all of them for calling in. I hate to end, but we will have you back, and we'll get to do this some more. I do want to remind everyone that Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Durlith, Tim Snell, Henry Edwards, and our own Dr. Lavo. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not be those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. Health Matters is made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and the Knoll Foundation. Again, I'd like to thank Dr. April Mackey for being here and answering our pet health questions. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Good evening.